is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, April 1st, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney. I'm out in Los Angeles, where we just finished our Sunday night broadcast. The Dodgers coming back to beat the St. Louis Cardinals in the final game of their series. Back in Connecticut in the Schwenk Studios is Taylor Schwenk. Taylor, late Sunday night taping. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Buster. I love a late night taping. I love when we can come off a whole day's worth of games and chat about them. An exciting first weekend of baseball, including the Baltimore Orioles. 2-1, baby. Yeah. Looking sharp.
Yeah, they're looking sharp for sure. But before we get to all that, we've got a lot of news and notes. We're going to be talking with David Cohn tonight in the clown car. We've got Sarah Langs joining us. We've got Tim Kirchen joining us. I think he's sitting in a car waiting for us as we talk now outside of his son's home in Pennsylvania. But my first question to you is, we're doing this late at night, East Coast time. How are you arranging the feedings with Lola, who is still, you know, less than 3 months old?
Yeah. She's 7 weeks old. So just a little pulling back the curtain here. My wife and I, we were working in shifts at first. Then we were all sleeping in the living room together. Practicing, alternating, getting up. You know, it's very scientific over here. But now it's a big night. We're all in the bedroom, back in the bed. Lola's in the bassinet, and we're going to do the alternating, getting up thing. But we're trying to establish some normalcy here. But because I'm up, I'm basically on call here until, about 3 a.m. whenever I'm done working here. So, if she rings the bell, I might have to run out of here.
And so by taping this late Sunday night, then that means that you can sleep till like 9 o'clock.
Yeah, you know, probably. From like 3 to 9. Yeah, it kind of works out. I'm doing my wife a favor. She can get basically a full night's sleep here and I'll get one on the back end. So really, it works out for everyone, especially Buster Olney.
Right, because I'm getting up early on Monday morning to fly back to Montana. All right, some news and notes. The Cubs, as expected, placed lefty Justin Steele on the injured list with a hamstring strain that happened in the first game of the season. You know, they know that he's not going to be back before the end of April. Pitchers Hennessy Cabrera and Johan Ramirez were each suspended 3 games apiece for roles in separate incidents. On Saturday, Cabrera exchanged words with Ray shortstop Jose Caballero, Cabrera shoved Caballero in the face, and Ramirez was disciplined after intentionally throwing at the Brewers' Rhys Hoskins during the 7th inning on Saturday. That's because on Friday, Rhys Hoskins was sliding into second base. He went over the bag. Jeff McNeil, the Mets second baseman, was unhappy with him. They were shouting at each other. Rhys Hoskins was doing the wah look at McNeil. And then on Saturday, the day after that happened, Rhys Hoskins hit a home run. He hit a single, and then the Mets threw at him, and that's when Ramirez got ejected. The city of Oakland's going to present the Athletics ownership with a lease extension possibility. And that includes a 5-year contract with an opt-out after 3 years. A follow-up MRI shows a fracture in the foot of Yankees third baseman DJ LeMahieu. He, of course, has been trying to work his way back, starts the year on the injured list, and now, let's face it, he's out indefinitely. All right, on Sunday Night Baseball, we had the Dodgers and the Cardinals. The Dodgers with that relentless offense. Before the game, Ollie Marmol, the manager of the Cardinals, basically said to us, look, the Dodgers are never out of it because of how much depth they had in their lineup. Early on, the Cardinals took the lead, top of the third.
First pitch swinging, and Goldschmidt lines it into left. That's down for a base hit. Victor Scott gets waved around. He is in well ahead of the throw, and the Cardinals are on the board first. An RBI single for Paul Goldschmidt, and it's 1-0 St. Louis here in the top of the third.
That was Mike Cousins on ESPN Radio. Now, in the top of the sixth inning, the Cardinals were trying to extend their lead. They had the bases loaded, Paul Goldschmidt at the plate, and then this happened.
And a 1-2 from Vesia. Swing and a missed strike three, and he gets out of the jam. Although it looks like, did we just get a catcher's interference call at the plate?
We did.
And so Goldschmidt is going to first, and Walker is coming in to score. And it's 4-0 St. Louis. That's the second straight night that there's been a catcher's interference called against Los Angeles.
So the Dodgers were down 4-0. The win probability was in favor of the Cardinals at 90%. They, of course, had won on Saturday. So the Cardinals at that moment are thinking, you know what? Maybe they're going to split this series against the Dodgers. In the bottom of the sixth inning, the Dodgers began to come back.
Runners at the 1-2. Swinging a number up the first baseline. Kittredge over to field it. Throws on to first and gets the out there. But in the process, Teoscar Hernandez comes home to score. And that makes it a 4-2 ball game.
And Hernandez came up again later in the game.
The 1-2 pitch. Swinging a well-struck ball out toward left field. Donovan back. He looks up at the wall and it's gone. Teoscar Hernandez with his third home run of the early season. A solo shot here in the bottom of the eighth. And we've got ourselves a one-run ball game. It's the Cardinals 4. And as Hernandez points to the heavens and touches home with his left foot, the Dodgers 3.
The Cardinals are working with a short bullpen after an extra inning game on Saturday. And it really showed up in the bottom of the eighth inning in this game. After Hernandez's home run, the Dodgers had another runner on base. And then Max Muncy came to the plate.
2-1 pitch. Muncy swinging a high fly ball out to deep right field. And Max Muncy gives the Dodgers the lead here in the eighth with a two-run blast. LA has trailed all day, but no longer. The Dodgers 5 and the Cardinals 4.
Yeah, Max Muncy probably has not hit a ball harder than he hit that one. There was a wind blowing from right field in Dodger Stadium over to left field, absolutely gusting, and he just drove it through that to give the Dodgers the lead. They win the game 5-4. Hot Ticket is brought to you by Vivid Seats, the official ticketing partner of ESPN. Get great deals on the hottest tickets. Experience it live. The hottest ticket was anybody who got to watch Juan Soto over the weekend. He was ridiculous in a four-game sweep for the Yankees against the Houston Astros, capped off by this hit in the top of the ninth inning Sunday.
There goes Torres, the third pitch. Line, base hit, left field. How do you like that? Torres scores. The Yankees take a 4-3 lead. Oh, is he good? Oh, do we love Soto.
Soto in his first four games for the Yankees, 9-for-17. And, of course, he also made a great play throwing a runner out at home plate during the course of the series. He turned things around. And Taylor, I think, you know, going forward, he had his first homer with the Yankees. We're not going to play it here. But have you heard John Sterling's call of Juan Soto's home run?
No, I haven't. Is this something
okay,
that you check
well,
out?
Okay, well, I've heard it. I've okay. heard what he does, but let's save it for the next time he hits a home run. What okay. do you think?
Yeah, that sounds good. I won't listen. I'll ignore all Juan Soto highlights from here on out. Easy.
The Phillies, the Braves, and in the bottom of the seventh inning, it was tied 3-3 when this happened.
And the 3-2 pitch swung on, line to left, falling. Duvall coming on, still coming, and he dives. He didn't catch it. It's under his glove. Both runs will score, and Alec Boehm has given the Phillies the lead. 5-3 here in the bottom of the seventh.
That was Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP. The Phillies salvaged the final game of that series. Something happened on Saturday, which I think could help lead to change in Major League Baseball. And I'm going to be talking with David Cohn and with Tim about that. The Brewers played the Mets, trying to finish off a sweep of New York, and William Contreras got a big hit.
The 1-1. Line down the right field line. This is a fair ball. It'll roll all the way into the corner for William Contreras. Tarang is around third. He will score. Contreras trades places with him. He stands at second with an RBI double, and it's 4-1 Milwaukee.
Yeah, and that would be the final score. They sweep the Mets. The Padres facing the Giants, and the Padres took control of this game in the bottom of the first.
Second and third with two outs. Swings at the first pitch. Hits it in the air to deep right. Wade's going back at the Petco porch wall. He looks. Going to go. Three-run home run. And Luis Camposano adds to the 2-0 lead. The Padres in front 5-0 here in the first.
The Blue Jays face the Tampa Bay Rays on Sunday. They won 9-2 with help from Justin Turner.
Just in that kind of complex setting. Turner takes the 0-2 pitch out to left field. A Rosarito watches it go. Home run, Justin Turner. He's driven in four runs for the Blue Jays today. It's 5-1 Toronto.
And the Diamondbacks, the defending champions of the National League, had a good weekend against the Rockies.
Here's the pitch. Swinging a ball ripped towards the left field corner. That is going to get down, and another run is going to score.
into second goes Gurriel on an RBI double, and it's now 5-1.
Man, it is fun to hear baseball highlights again. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, we have a new episode of the College Game Day podcast. Pete Thamel, Jeff Borzello, they linked up after the last games here on Sunday and had a little chat. It is up on YouTube. You can listen to it on this podcasting platform as well.
All right, this is going to be a smaller version of the clown car because Eduardo Perez and Carl Ravitch have escaped to the airport, to LAX, the mess that is there. But I've got David Cohn here with me, and David, in the first week, I always like to, after these first games, to sort of give first impressions. So let's talk about the Dodgers. We saw them this weekend. You know, we all arrived from Texas on Friday. Your first impressions of L.A.?
Well, we kind of knew coming into the season that their offense was going to be a juggernaut and what it was going to look like with the talent at the top of the order. But to me, the story is still homegrown starting pitching. When you think about Bobby Miller and you think about Gavin Stone today, looked really good. I think the Dodgers organization is very strong. The story is always about the money they spent and the free agency play that they made, but seeing a young pitcher that you developed in your organization is the most uplifting thing for any organization, especially starting pitching. They have two really good ones.
So you kind of stole my thunder. I was going to talk about Kevin Stone to watch him pitch on Sunday Night Baseball. What stands out to you about him?
You just see the growth from last year to this year. He has a more of a full repertoire now. Basically a two-pitch pitcher last year with a fastball and a changeup. Now he has two different kinds of fastballs. He's learned how to two-seam it and four-seam it, which is really coming into vogue in today's game where pitchers, especially starters, are throwing two different kinds of fastballs and hitters are kind of behind the curve trying to catch up to that style. And he's got a plus-plus changeup. And certainly he's learned kind of that east and west style of pitching with the two-seamer and the cutter to go with that great changeup and kind of a good four-seamer as well.
So you know at some point, you know, they probably will get Clayton Kershaw back. They've got James Paxton. Walker Buehler will be coming back. They've already got Yamamoto. When I was watching him tonight, I was imagining games in October with him being like a two and a third inning guy. You know, take you from like the fifth inning to the seventh inning, which is, you know, and Dave Roberts' time as manager has been a problem for them. And you heard Dave Roberts gushing about him before the game.
They love his makeup. They love his character. And, you know, I mean, those are sort of buzzwords and phrases about, you know, inside baseball, what the guy's like, you know, how his teammates like him, how he handles adversity. When he gets the bases loaded or he has kind of a rough outing or a rough inning, how does he bounce back? And he seems to have passed those tests all along. And certainly he can fill multiple roles for you because he can get right-handers and lefties out. He throws his changeup very well to lefties but also to righties. So there's really no platoon splits there that would worry you about him having to face left-handers or coming out of the bullpen in postseason or whatever his role ends up being. But I think long-term, he's a heck of a prospect to be a starting pitcher.
All right, so a lot of conversation about Mookie Betts this weekend, who came into the Sunday night game hitting, what, 6-11 with a 720 on base percentage and, you know, an adjusted OPS plus of like 435. But the thing that jumped out to me in the conversations that we had with Dave, you know, we asked about him possibly playing the outfield this year, and he was unequivocal about him basically staying in the infield, talking about the over-under in his eyes of him, in a number of innings he plays in the outfield this year, being at 2.5. How surprised were you about that and you know, what we've seen about what we've seen of Mookie in the infield?
Well, we saw Mookie sort of over the last year, really last year in particular, yearning to play second base. That's what he came up in the minor leagues as a second baseman. It almost feels like he's looking for a challenge. You know, he was kind of used to the juice on the East Coast playing for the Red Sox and the Yankee rivalry there and kind of the intensity of the East Coast. But now I feel like he's almost energized by the challenge of playing shortstop. He wants it. It's not like he's making a big concession to play the infield, to move around and play second and short. This is something that he thrives on and that he really wants. And That's the type of personality Mookie is. He loves the challenge, and he seems re-energized by this sort of a challenge where most other players, really the vast majority of other players, would be intimidated or to go out there and put themselves in a position to be embarrassed, in a position they've never played. And that's not Mookie. Mookie's embracing it, and not only embracing it, but as I said before, he seems re-energized by it.
And I love Dave Roberts' words when he talked about the work he's doing in the infield, and he talked about how he's obsessed, was the word that Dave used, with improving defensively. And he said it was Kobe-like in his effort to get better. We also asked Dave about Shohei Ohtani, who, of course, has gotten off to very small sample size, slow start. To this point, he has two extra base hits in the first six games, does not have a home run. And the natural question is everything going on with his former interpreter, the investigation that has started not only from federal authorities but from Major League Baseball, is that wearing on him? And Dave made the case that, in his eyes, this is someone who's very strong mentally. He compared him to Corey Seager as a standard for him, a player who could wall stuff off. David, I got to tell you, like, in watching Ohtani, I think it's the good old-fashioned, high-priced guy changes teams, and now he's surrounded by new teammates, and he feels the pressure to impress them. That would be my guess.
I think that's a big part of it, too. We don't really discuss the physical part either, that the guy had his second Tommy John surgery, and that how does that affect your hitting, or is he fully healthy? And even though he can swing the bat, and he seems like he is, to me, I'm still sort of wondering if, physically speaking, if he's completely 100% as well. So, aside from all the off-the-field stuff and the confusion surrounding the rollout of the explanation of everything that happened, yeah, maybe he can compartmentalize. He's strong mentally. He's very one-dimensional in his mindset about being the best baseball player in the history of the game. It still has to get to you when something like that happens and there's an ongoing investigation. He is human after all, even though he seems kind of inhuman at times.
So now on the other side, we've got the St. Louis Cardinals. Their big push in the offseason was revamping their starting pitching, and we didn't see Sonny Gray this weekend. He's still on the injured list. They're hoping he comes back within a couple weeks or so. After seeing them this weekend, I'm walking away from here basically saying, look, unless Nolan Arenado and Paul Goldschmidt hit as stars in the way that they're being paid, and I don't mean that pejoratively, that's just the structure of the team and where the investments is, I have a hard time seeing this team playing deep into October.
Well, it's a valid point, and it's you have to get to the trade deadline, because that's the decision time, especially for Goldschmidt, who's a free agent at 37 years old at the end of the year. So it's almost like the Cardinals have about 2 months here, 2.5 months to really get a look-see and find out where they are. And that's a tough spot to be in as a team when you're thinking about, okay, we're in the National League Central. A lot of the predictions or the prognosticators are saying that we're the favorite to win the division because it's a weaker division this year. But nonetheless, to your point, Buster, long-term thinking, they've got about 3 months to make a decision in which direction they're going to go and whether they're in it and keep these guys, or whether they're going to try to sign Goldschmidt to stay around, or whether they offer up some of their older players to other teams at the trade deadline.
Did you see anything from their young guys that jumped out at you? Victor Scott the second, Mason Winn the shortstop, maybe a pitcher who caught your eye this weekend?
Yeah, it just seems like to me that they're following the model of the Arizona Diamondbacks to get younger, more athletic, speed. Obviously the rules changes last year left some of the teams kind of behind the curve a little bit. And when you see the success of the Diamondbacks, it makes you realize as an organization that that's what we have to get to. And that's what they're trying to do with all the athleticism, all the speed. I'm not saying we're going to see Whitey ball again from the 80s, but certainly that's becoming more and more prevalent. And it feels like teams are realizing, hey, stolen base is back in play. It was an 80% success rate last year. A lot of teams left some meat on the table, meat on the bone, so to speak, in terms of we need to try more. We need to take more chances. We need to use speed as part of the game, and that plays on defense as well. So that's where you see, a young shortstop with great athleticism and a young center fielder with great athleticism. That's the future for the Cardinals. Now, the question for them is the veteran pieces, how they fit in and whether they stay or not, and whether that that translates into a potential division title or postseason play.
I got three national things for you. Given your familiarity with the Yankees, with superstar players joining the Yankees and going through a transition, what'd you make of Juan Soto's weekend?
It couldn't have gone better. Yankee universe is absolutely on fire, waiting to see this guy come to the Bronx. I think, you know, that the part that's enticing to the Yankee fan base, especially the younger fan base, is just sort of this unfiltered enthusiasm that Juan Soto has, the way he plays the game, the Soto shuffle. He did an interview with his hat turned backwards after sweeping the Astros. That's just something you haven't seen in a Yankee uniform, somebody who just doesn't care. I am who I am. I'm here to play. I'm exciting. I know it. And I'm flamboyant, and I'm not afraid to show that. And, you know, that's something, if you've been a Yankee fan for a long time, you haven't seen. It's always been the staid, true blue, you know, conservative kind of approach, and wear your hat straight, show the logo. Juan Soto is changing all that seemingly overnight.
So we had a situation in Philadelphia on Saturday where Max Fried was trying to pitch his way out of a first-inning jam. He has a 2-2 count on Nick Castellanos. He throws a 98-mile-an-hour fastball middle-middle, right down the middle of the plate. And Bruce Dreckman, the experienced umpire behind home plate, calls it a ball. And Fried winds up walking him. He doesn't get out of the inning. And it certainly, in my mind, sparked, you know, more conversation about when are we going to get the ABS system. And in conversations with people around baseball, my sense is that's something that we could see as soon as next year. And it was interesting because I spent a day doing that. And then when we got into Ollie's office today before the game, it was one of the questions that you had, like, you know, what do you think about this concept? So I'll ask you that question. What do you think about an ABS challenge system?
I absolutely think it's the proper compromise. Rather than just going full automated strike zone, which would sort of disenfranchise the whole catching industry and the framing industry, it would just sort of make that irrelevant at this point. So that's not something I see that's going to happen or that'll get passed. But yes, seventh inning, bases loaded, or even early in the game like that. First inning, Max Fried's approaching 40 pitches. There's one strike that could maybe get you out of the inning, change your whole outing. I'm absolutely in favor of that. And I think the fans would be too. I think the fans would light up to be able to see the scoreboard and see a challenge system and see a call overturn that changes the whole complexion of the game. I absolutely think that would be a good thing in baseball.
What's interesting is I tweeted that out yesterday on Saturday, and a lot of the reaction was, well, that's just going to slow the game down even more. And anybody who's sending that out hasn't seen it in action. I mean, it's instantaneous down in the minor leagues. And I like the idea of, you know, three per game. So you don't get, you know, a grumpy hitter asking a strike one call in the second inning. Asking for a challenge, it would be waiting for big spots to emerge in a game like we saw with Max Fried.
You know, again, I completely agree, and I think it involves the fans. The fans participate in this. They see the challenge. They see the player once they get familiar with it, and then they'll look at the scoreboard. And you're exactly right, Buster. I think the timing of it is really going to be negligent at most because – you know, the technology is such that nowadays it does happen very quickly. And then it's sort of like tennis at Wimbledon or some of the major tennis tournaments. You see the play happen, you see the call challenge, and it happens so quickly, and you could actually see where the pitch was. That's engaging for the fans. On a big scoreboard, some of these big screens we have in the major league stadiums now, you'll be able to see very clearly the technology and the pitch and, you know, however you want to show it, where the pitch was and why the pitch was overturned or the call was overturned or not. I think fans will react to that with roaring applause or boos or whatnot, but it'll be clear and very convincing that once they see that technology.
Coney, thanks. I'll see you in Texas.
Yep, see you in Texas. Here we go.
Seam heads rejoice. This is Timmy Time.
Baseball is the greatest game.
With Tim Kirkson.
It never disappoints you.
On Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirkson covers baseball for ESPN, and his voice a little muffled because another thing he does is he's a grandfather, okay? And he's got a grandchild who he's trying not to wake. So, Tim, if you could describe where you are right at the moment.
I'm sitting in my car in my son's driveway in Schwenksville, Pennsylvania. I just did baseball tonight, jumped in the car, drove 3.5 hours to get here because I have to work with him on some things tomorrow. But instead of going into the house in the middle of the night when everyone's asleep and stumbling all over the place and trying to set up something technological, I figure it's easier to sit in the car and do it this way.
Okay, so but you're okay. You believe that there's no neighborhood watch, no cops, no dogs that might be wondering who what you're doing, you know, talking to yourself, talking baseball at near midnight.
Well, if someone comes by, I'll just wave them off because I'm in a car, I'm in a driveway, and I've been here many times. They know what my all the neighbors know what my car looks like.
Okay. Well, that's a relief. I've got a list of topics to hit on today. You got to start with Juan Soto after that incredible weekend that he had. Tell me what you saw on him and what it means for the Yankees.
Well, he reached base 12 times in 4 games. So that ties a Yankee record for most times reached base in your first 4 games as a Yankee. But it was so much more than that, Buster. And if I may, it's exactly what I thought was going to happen when Juan Soto joined this team. He was going to show everyone what a great approach at the plate looks like in every single plate appearance. His focus on every single pitch is stunning. His pitch selection, his pitch discipline is amazing. And he had such a great series, and nothing was better than the hit he got today off of Josh Hader, you know, on something 97 on the outside part of the plate. But instead of trying to do too much with it, he went with it and lined a single to left field. It was absolutely beautiful. He had another at bat today where he saw there's a hole at shortstop. They're shifting him. And instead of trying to pull the ball, he had a ground single into left center field. This is why he is arguably the best hitter in the game. And he is teaching the rest of the Yankees, this is what a great at-bat looks like on an every at-bat basis. It was so impressive what he did in Houston. And of course, he had the biggest defensive play of the entire series when he made the throw to the plate to get Mauricio Dubon.
So there are a lot of times when, you know, we will talk about, well, this team hasn't beaten this team in this many years. And, you know, the streak is going on. And the players would tell you, no, that doesn't really matter. For example, the Minnesota Twins haven't beaten the Yankees in the playoffs for like 150 years. Right. And that's the dynamic that was between the Yankees and the Astros. And it still exists. You know, the Yankees, you know, this series happens at the end of March. But, Tim, I think it means something. Like, I think it was really important for the Yankees to have some sort of success against the Astros in Houston.
I don't think there's any doubt, Buster. After they won the first game, let alone the first 4 games, I said to myself, that was a huge win for the Yankees. They didn't just beat the Astros. They beat them on the road. And they were down 4-0 in the first inning and came back to win that game in dramatic fashion. That first game was really important. All 4 of these games, Buster, I don't know if you saw it afterwards, but with Judge, Soto, and Verdugo ran off the field after Verdugo made the catch to win the game in the 9th inning, I never saw that sort of joy and excitement once from the Yankees all last year. And again, it wasn't a good year. They went 82-80, but they're going to draw so much from what they did in those 4 games in Houston. I am not overstating this. That's the one place they needed to win, and they went in there and played exceptionally well.
All right. And during this series, Framber Valdez had a really rough outing. I think it was, what, 5 hits and 6 walks and 5 1/3 innings, something along those lines in the opener. And when I saw Ryan Pressly pitch, and I'm not going to tell you that I saw every pitch of this series because, you know, I'm out here in L.A. and working on those games. But I must say, those two guys in particular, my first impression was, ooh, that is a major concern for the Astros as they move forward. And I kind of wonder if Ryan Pressly might fit the category, Tim. And you and I have seen a lot of relievers who are like this. When they pitch in the 9th inning, they are Superman, right? They've got the cape. That is their... You know, there's something about them, their belief in themselves, where they believe that they're going to find a way through. Ryan Pressly's not pitching the ninth inning anymore, and the slider that I saw the other day just seemed flattened out. Tell me what your impressions of the Astros, and, you know, do you feel like now that maybe there's some questions about this team?
Well, I'm not worried about the Astros yet. I think they're going to get that bullpen together. But you're right about closers. I remember when Eric Gagne was so dominant as a closer, and then they put him in the eighth inning, and it didn't go very well. And I've made this point, Buster, after Mariano Rivera, you could make the case that the best postseason closer, which is really 1969 on, is Ryan Pressly. That's how great he has been in the postseason. And even though he's a great teammate and a great guy, and he says, I'll do whatever it takes to help the team, it's a completely different role when you don't have the ball in the ninth inning. I'm going to give him time to figure this out. And when Abreu, Pressly, and Hader start going, that bullpen's going to be tremendous. But yes, that could potentially be an issue. And Framber Valdez, despite his tremendous stuff, that sinker, the ridiculous curveball he throws, he can get erratic. He can lose his poise. I've seen it. And, you know, he didn't have it the other day, that's for sure. So that's something to keep your eye on when they have some other issues with health in the starting rotation.
All right. The Mets over the weekend play the Milwaukee Brewers. It was not a good weekend for the Mets. They were swept in their home ballpark. And I think they kind of were made to look a little silly, Tim, in my opinion, with everything that went on with Rhys Hoskins, where, you know, he's a hard slide into second base. Jeff McNeil was unhappy and he's yelling at him. And he had Rhys Hoskins doing the, you know, crybaby thing with his eyes and going, wah, yelling at him. And then the umpires reviewed the slide and they determined it was a perfectly legal slide. And then the next day, the Mets wait until after he's hit a two-run single and a two-run homer before someone tries to throw at him. And Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez on the Mets broadcast basically said, well, that was 2 hours too late. It was a terrible first weekend for the Mets. What do you think?
Yeah, it really was. And look, I don't want anyone getting hurt around second base. All right. But that was a clean slide. It was a hard slide. And we don't see hard, clean slides anymore, because when we changed the rule, which was a terrible idea, by the way, to change the rule around second base, we now are not allowed to come anywhere near the second baseman or the shortstop. And I find that regrettable, because this is still a very physical game. And I thought Jeff O'Neill overreacted on this. And, you know, everyone knows Rhys Hoskins goes in hard. That's what he's supposed to do. He didn't know that McNeil was not going to get a double play on that. He's got to go in and take the guy out. That's his job. So it was bad, and then you're right. And I think Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez are right. If you're going to send the message, you send it immediately the next day. You don't wait until the fourth plate appearance and then throw over his head.
All right, on Saturday as well, we had a game between the Phillies and the Braves. I think it was the Braves who wound up winning this game. But the moment that stuck out to me was in the first inning when Max Fried was trying to labor his way through a long first inning. His pitch count was nearing 40. He's got Nick Castellanos at the plate. 2-2 pitch with two outs. Fastball, Tim, middle. 98 miles per hour, right down the middle. And Bruce Streckman, the home plate umpire, called it a ball. And then at that point, 3-2 count, he walked Castellanos. He winds up having to come out of the game. He doesn't finish the inning. And the Braves bullpen is kind of in a mess for the rest of the day and maybe for the next couple of days. And to me, it was maybe one of the most perfect examples that I've seen that baseball needs the ABS challenge system. And I think that may come as soon as next year. In fact, if I had to guess, I think that's when it's going to happen. And I think this is a classic situation where, you know, Bruce Streckman is a respected umpire. Maybe he blinked. I don't know. But he, you know, just missed the call. It's not good for anybody, Tim. And we know from what we've seen in the minor leagues, the ABS challenge system is really quick. You know, in that situation, you know, if you were to have three per team per game, then the Braves could have said, yes, we want to challenge that. Like in tennis, boom, they would have been called a strike and they could have moved on. Instead, it kind of turns everything into a bit of a mess. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I did that game on the radio for ESPN, and it was clear that Max Fried was thrown off by that call. Now, he was not sharp from the beginning. He didn't have any of his best stuff, but it was clear he was really upset about that pitch, and soon he didn't even get out of the first inning in the shortest outing of his entire career. And I think you're right about the challenge system. I think it's coming sooner rather than later. I've talked to enough hitters and pitchers who think it's a good idea. Again, I'm against too much technology coming in, but that's something that has worked so well. And that's all I ever ask is show me that it works exceptionally well in the minor leagues before we take it in the major leagues. But I just know Max Fried was upset about that. But sorry, sometimes you got to work your way through a bad call. And he was incapable of doing that for once because he normally has great poise.
Taylor's Orioles are off to a good start. They take their first series against the Angels. What do we make of them early on?
Well, their offense is really good, Buster. I mean, they just clobbered the Angels two games in a row. Gunnar Henderson looks like an MVP candidate already. You know, I just think they can score runs in so many different ways. Anthony Santander with 29 homers last year and kind of was invisible with all the young guys they have around there. And, of course, Corbin Burnes was absolutely brilliant. No walks, 11 strikeouts, one hit allowed in his Oriole debut. So I was amused all spring that some of these websites and everything had the Orioles at 84 wins a year after winning 101 games. And they acquired the best pitcher available on the market. So I really love where the Orioles are. And Mr. Holliday is in the minor leagues. It won't be too long before he's up in the big league. And I really like where they're going. And they knocked around not a very good Angels team, but Orioles are here for a long time.
All right. So we had a great BS session on Saturday in here in L.A. We, at a table, we had David Cohn and Eduardo Perez and Carl Ravitch and Doug Glanville. We solved all the world's problems. And one thing that came up was the possibility that the Marlins at some point soon will have some kind of a sell-off because they look kind of ugly. And Coney, I think, was the first one to mention, like, you know what? Jesus Luzardo, they should definitely consider trading him. He's building up service time, and the Orioles must be the team that goes and gets him. What do you think?
Yeah, he's really good. And I'm really worried for the Marlins' sake if in what direction they are going. I still cannot understand a team that made the playoffs last year did virtually nothing to improve what had to be done to improve an offense, and they had to add some pitching given the pitching injuries they have, Alcantara and others. I'm really confused why they didn't do more. And if they're incapable of doing more, now's the time to sell off because that was a bad series against the Pirates, who are way better than people think. But yes, if the Marlins don't show quick improvement here, we could see some trades being made.
I think it was Eduardo who noted that in 7 years with the Atlanta Braves, Ron Washington probably saw zero team meetings, and there was a team meeting with the Angels after his second game as their manager. What do we make of this?
Well, that's the earliest I've ever heard about a team meeting. Remember, Buster, I learned baseball mostly from Earl Weaver, who told me once, he said, I never call a team meeting. He says, what if you call a team meeting and then you lose? What do you do then? Well, Ron Washington was so upset with the way the team played the first two games, and rightly so, especially the way they pitched, given how energetic he is and how forceful he is on so many things. I'm not surprised he closed the doors and said, look, we're going to come back, but this is unacceptable. I don't know exactly what he said, but that was probably the message. Ron Washington is not going to wait around and watch a team stumble. He's going to take a proactive approach. Two games in, never seen that before, but it seemed to work because they won the third game.
All right, if you look at the top of the National League Central standings, you see the Pittsburgh Pirates. I think you'd agree with me that, you know, especially with the injury to Justin Steele, the problems that the Cardinals are having, the upgrades that the Reds made, it's really, really difficult to determine who could win this division. I do think that, you know, the Brewers, despite their great weekend against the Mets, I kind of wonder if they've got enough starting pitching to hang in there. But what do we make of the Pirates at the top of the National League Central?
Well, it's really impressive the way they played this weekend. I mean, Jared Jones, who struck out 10 a couple days ago, he's got a chance to be really good. That was his major league debut, and he was overpowering. They got Paul Skeens in the minor leagues. And he's been absolutely tremendous in his first start at AAA, or in the minor leagues. I can't believe he's going to be down there too much longer. When you have this kind of young talent, you've got O'Neill Cruz back. You've got the catcher, Henry Davis, playing the position he should be playing. This is such a winnable division that I have already, one weekend into the season, put the Pirates into that race. I think it's a five-team race. And I don't think you're going to need 90 wins to win it, but I love what they're doing. They have two pretty good relievers at the back end of the bullpen. Pirates are much better than we thought, and I think we can say that after 5 days of the season.
Tim, I beat Jake in my NCAA bracket, which really is the only important thing to me. I had to beat him. How is your bracket?
Well, this is like the first year I didn't do a bracket. I just got lost.
You're a basketball guy.
I love basketball. I'm sorry. I just got lost in other things that I was doing. And before I knew it, it was 1 o'clock on Thursday. I missed all the games, so I couldn't do it. My son, he sent me that, just said, "Dad, here, fill this out. I forgot to do it. I apologize. My fault."
All right. Well, don't get stopped by the police on your walk into your son's house, okay? Thank you so much.
No, he's left the front door open. I'm good. So thanks for having me, and I didn't wake anyone up. We won.
0096. This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter-producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how you doing in this late Sunday night?
I'm doing great, Wester. How are you?
Yeah, we just got done Sunday Night Baseball, but I imagine you're going to be up for another, like, 5 hours, probably processing more of what you saw over the first weekend, maybe because you can't get to sleep because there was so much good stuff this weekend.
Oh, my gosh, there was so much good stuff. It's really, really great first weekend. Can't wait to see what the rest of the season brings.
All right, so before we get to any of that, how'd your bracket turn out? Your NCAA bracket. Did you kill it?
I did. I had Houston winning, so that went down. I don't know where I rank right now. I haven't checked it since that happened. I knew I wasn't in a good spot. I was very chalky this year, and so that worked for like the first 2 days, and after that, not so much.
All right. So you know who else picked Houston to win?
No.
My son, Jake. And because he did, it meant that I beat him, which is the only thing that matters. Like, we had 9 people, and I'm either going to finish second or third, but the only thing that matters to me is that I beat Jake. So thanks to Houston for losing. That's the way I felt. Like, I just needed to beat Jake because he was talking some serious smack, Sarah.
I mean, all that matters is the family bragging, right? So I love that.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 12. So one of the great things we've seen in these first 4 days of the season stateside is Juan Soto being exactly as advertised for the Yankees, really changing the game for them in multiple ways. He had the run thrown out at home in their first game on opening day. In the ninth inning, in the key spot, he had the go-ahead hit on Sunday. And he has been on base 12 times so far, which is no surprise to anyone who's been watching him. But that is tied for the most times on base by any player in his first 4 career games with the Yankees, with Bob Watson in 1980 and Pat Collins in 1926. By the way, kind of blue to us. In the first 3 games of the Yankees were all comeback wins. This is a bonding franchise. They've been so good in so many ways. It was only the second time in franchise history that they had won each of their first three games, all in comeback fashion. The other one's in 1957.
Number two.
Number two is 111.7 miles an hour. So another player who has quickly made an impact that was expected but very good to see on his new team is Matt Chapman. We knew his defense is, of course, game-changing. As I talked to you about on here, I believe when he signed, he also hits the ball really hard. So in the multi-homer game on Friday, in his second game with the team, second home run, 111.7 miles an hour off the bat. The Giants only have one home run hit harder than that all of last season. That just tells you what he's bringing on another level to the team. Really, really good to see.
Number one.
Number one is three. So in our Sunday baseball game, the Dodgers and Gavin Stone went 3-of-3 down, all in strikeouts in the first inning. The correct definition of strikeout the side, strikeout everyone you face. The Dodgers have done that now in three straight games. First inning, 3-of-3 down, all on strikeouts. They're the first team in at least the expansion era, which goes back to 1961, which is how far back we have on complete play-by-play data. They're the first team with a streak that long to end that span. They're the first team to do this in three straight games. I just think that's incredible. And by the way, they're doing this without Clayton Kershaw back in, without Walker Buehler, without Dustin May. I mean, their pitchers are really good, but this was a bit of a question. An untested and generally not so veteran pitching staff. So for them to be the ones to set this record is really, really good sign.
Yeah, I got to say, I saw Gavin Stone, I remember a little bit in the past, but tonight was the first time I saw him pitch in person. Man, he's impressive. All right, this is the overreaction Monday. It's the first Monday after the start of the regular season. So give me a player or a team where you feel like what you've seen so far is, yep, that's what we're going to see all year. Well, you know, you could say the Pittsburgh Pirates if you wanted to, off to a great start. You could say the Yankees. You could say Juan Soto. I personally am landing on Mookie Betts. I feel like a genius because I picked Mookie Betts to win the MVP in the National League this year. It just feels like he's locked in and going into this game on Sunday night. He's batting 6-11. Give me a team or a player that you're overreacting on.
I mean, for me, it has to be Juan Soto, but I don't think it's an overreaction. I think it's real. I think this is just what he's going to do. I mean, even in that inning where they went head on Sunday, he comes up with guys on, he drives in the run, Aaron Judge strikes out after that, or maybe ground out. But the point is, last year, there's no other impact bat. Last year, it all comes down to what Judge does in that situation. Now they have two incredible options there and just completely changes the game for them. I think you can make an argument. Obviously, the Astros bullpen definitely struggled this weekend. That is certainly a concern moving forward. But you can make an argument that without the impact of Soto, and we impact the entire game and their lineup, they certainly are not 4-0 entering Monday without him. And I think that's what he's going to do. And again, it's the reaction, the emotion. I mean, he is out there yelling and screaming in the moments he should be celebrating. You see him, and that is like all of the energy that you expected he would bring to New York. And he hasn't even played a Yankee senior yet. I feel like after doing this, especially in Houston, with the Yankee fans' opinions of the Astros and their history in the playoffs, I mean, the ovation he was already going to get is so loud, and now it's going to be even louder.
Yeah, he's going to have the Yankees trying to re-sign him as a free agent, and he's going to have the Mets coming after him, and I think there's an excellent chance that Shohei Ohtani's record, $461 million deal, present-day value, I think there's an excellent chance that's going to fall given the bidding that's being set up for and the start to this season. All right, Sarah, thank you so much. Great to see you. I will talk to you later.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Rosser.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Monday. Bleacher Tweets. We've got a sponsor, Buster.
Nice.
They are brought to you by DirecTV. Get the best of live sports and streaming together. No satellite dish required. Big news there. Now stream DirecTV satellite free. We're doing a voicemail exclusive edition of Bleacher Tweets. The Bleacher Tweets voicemail box number. You can find it in the show notes. That number is 406-404-8460. Let's listen to our first voicemail.
Hey, Buster and crew. This is Michael Andora out in Durham, North Carolina. Seen shifts with how rotations are used, starting back in 2017 when you saw the Dodgers and Astros playing the World Series, and those were the two teams that limited their starters seeing the lineups a third time through the most. You've seen Kevin Cash use the opener quite a bit. Other teams adopt that. Do you think a six-man rotation would become more prevalent with the amount of injuries we see with starting pitchers?
Yeah, it's a great question. By the way, Taylor, one thing that's been really cool about the Bleacher Tweets, they are coming from across the country.
Yes.
Like, it feels like that we're, you know, we got one down south, and then we got one out west, and then we get one from North Carolina. I think that's really cool. So to answer the question, yes, I do. I think more and more teams are going to get comfortable with the idea of a six-man rotation. I thought the Milwaukee Brewers really popularized it, you know, and it helped them to keep Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff, Freddie Peralta fresh. The Dodgers are having to do a little bit of that. They're going to give extra rest to Yoshi Yamamoto, who, by the way, looked great on Saturday. In his second start in the big leagues. So I do think that that's another possibility. The bottom line is that you're seeing the number of innings that pitchers throw steadily diminishing. At the high end now, it feels like if you throw 150 innings, that's a big number these days.
Next up.
Hey, Buster. This is Andrew, Texas Rangers fan living in New Jersey. First, I just wanted to say welcome back, Taylor, and congrats again on having a child. And Buster, it's been great that you've been getting your daughter involved in the show. A lot of family energy is fantastic. My question is about Max Scherzer. So his return date seemingly has gotten moved up. It seemed like it might be June. Now it might be May. And I feel like they might be rushing that. Am I overthinking it? I feel like they should take his time. Obviously, we would want some help in the starting rotation sooner rather than later. But we also did pretty well with this same rotation just last year, and I'd rather they wait for Max, who, and again, I might be exaggerating here, but this could be his last season, being how injury-prone he's been, and just age and other factors. So am I overthinking it? Should I just welcome Max Scherzer back whenever they can and trust in the process that Chris Young and his team are doing? Or does it seem a little weird that they're bringing him back earlier than before? Thanks, as always. Love the show. You guys are the best. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Really kind words there. I actually had a conversation with Max before the game, before the opener, and most of what we talked about were his kids. And you can tell, like, Max is going to be like the guy, the dad who coaches all of his kids in sports. He was all excited because his son apparently is left-handed. He was fired up about that news. I don't know if this is going to be his last year or not. I would say that from the first day after the procedure that he had, and I'm not going to try to remember the specifics of the procedure, but he told me that he had a lot of signs of strength being much better than I think anybody expected. And yes, the fact that he was not placed on the 60-day injured list to start the year was an indication that he could come back sometime middle of May, end of May. At this point, at his age, I'm taking whatever he can give you. You know, I mean, down the stretch, it was the same way with him. He wasn't going to give you eight innings pitching in the World Series, in pitching in the playoffs, but, you know, he was available, and I think that's the way it's going to be the rest of the year. He's going to give you what he's got.
Hey, this is Corey from South Carolina. My question is, why the off day on day two? Everybody's excited. We're all ready to watch our games, and there's the off day on the second day of the season. Why don't we save this to last half of the first half or sometime during the summer when teams are playing 2 weeks straight? What do you think?
So, Corey, the reason why a lot of teams build in the off day, the second day, is to protect themselves against the possibility of rain. So, you know, if you're a Northeast team, for example, you're the Yankees, and you have opening day scheduled and rains in the forecast, and this is what happened with the Mets. It's what happened with the Phillies. The weather was bad, so then it gave them an extra day to work with in terms of playing the schedule. Now, you do occasionally get the weird ones. Taylor, you know, this is noted by the Rangers players to me. Like, they play in a dome, right? There's no chance of a rainout. They played on Thursday. They're off Friday. Then they played again on Saturday. That confused everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to put that question there because I feel like I had some friends being like, why aren't the Orioles playing on Friday? And that was my first thought, too. But, yeah, I mean, they were on the razor's edge of a big rainstorm there, so they might have had to have opening day on Friday. Last one here for the show.
Hey, Buster. Hey, Taylor. This is Kirk from Indiana. Taylor, congratulations on the baby. I have three girls, so if you need any advice, just give me a call back. Hey, my question is that a few years ago we were hearing about how a lot of infielders just didn't know how to play the positions and they were using their athleticism to overcome those feelings. Is the Mookie Betts at shortstop situation maybe a good reason why you should favor guys who are really athletic instead of really good at playing the position?
Yeah, so I think Mookie's an outlier. It's a little bit like, so I don't know if, you know, what we say about him or what we see out of him applies to anybody else. It's kind of like when people talk about innings and throwing regimens, they'll bring up, well, Nolan Ryan threw 5,000 innings. And my reaction's always been, well, that was Nolan Ryan. He was just this crazy great, great physical specimen. It's the same thing with Mookie. I was really surprised to hear Dave Roberts basically commit to playing him in the infield all the time going forward. It was really cool to hear his stories about how hard Mookie is working to make this a go. And it's neat too, where he just it really does feel like this is just a situation where Mookie moving to the infield, he's just more engaged and he feels like he's more of a part of things, doing the same thing he did growing up and when he was in the minor leagues with the Red Sox.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets, Buster. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. I read them. Don't worry. If you tweeted at us, I read them. I just decided to go with the voicemails today. And that number is 406-404-8460. It's in the show notes. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for writing in. We will be back on Wednesday.
All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Taylor and to Sarah and to David Cohn and to Tim Kirchner, who I really hope has not been arrested outside of his son's home. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.